Hey, and welcome to the premiere of Nashville Public Radio's new podcast, Movers and Thinkers. I'm Emily Seiner, your host. Welcome. Before we get started, I just want to say this is our very first episode of Movers and Thinkers, and we have a lot of room to grow. So please, after you finish listening, give us your feedback. Email us at movers@wpln.org. You're probably wondering what in the world this podcast is. So here's how I like to think of it. Take one part of TED Radio Hour, where you have just really interesting people speaking about one theme, and then add a little bit of the interviewing style of Fresh Air. Now, lower your expectations a little bit, because I'm not quite Terry Gross yet. And then make that mix specific to Nashville. Everyone we talk to on the show will be from the community, because, as it turns out, there are a lot of interesting people doing interesting things here. Each show is taped live. Our premiere was in WPLN Studio C in April, and we had about 50 people from the community who came and listened and asked questions. For our first show, we invited three people who work behind the scenes in their fields. A pastry chef.
He was hunched over this pie, and he's crying.
A printer at Nashville's iconic Hat Show Print.
At the end of the day, they may know our hands really well, but they may not remember our faces.
And a computer hacker.
I was in high school, and I had a federal agent come to my school.
We call them invisible movers because their work is all very influential in different ways, but many people would never think about their existence. Alex Berta is a cybersecurity expert who's currently an associate at KPMG LLP, one of the big four accounting firms. He got his start as a teenage computer hacker and interacted with all sorts of high-profile hacking collectives. Now he uses his expertise to help clients thwart cybersecurity dangers. Selene Aubrey is a manager and printer designer at Hat Show Print. That's one of America's oldest letterpress shops, most famous for its music posters for the Ryman. It recently moved to a studio at the Country Music Hall of Fame and now has a big window where people can actually see the designers making the posters by hand. And Lisa Donovan is an acclaimed pastry chef who's currently traveling around the country teaching cooking classes with her business Buttermilk Road. She recently ended her tenure as the head pastry chef of Husk Nashville and has worked at a number of other well-known Nashville restaurants, including Margot and City House. She says she got started in the food business from the front of the restaurant as a waitress.
I had always baked, and I was doing a bunch of freelance baking because my husband's a sculptor. I was a writer. We barely had that pot to piss in. So we were like, I was making breads and I was making cakes. And then I started waiting tables at Margot. They started seeing all of these things going out of the door. People would start to pick them up. And every once in a while, someone that I really liked at the restaurant would have a birthday and I would make a mountainous Dolly Parton boob cake. And it would, and everyone's like, who knew you could do this? If you talk to any pastry chef that is helming any great kitchen in this country, they were either a painter or a dancer or a writer or something completely off the wall. And they came around to working in a pastry kitchen from the front of the house.
So which parts of your job, which parts are behind the scenes and which aren't? Is there any part that's not behind the scenes?
I mean, initially, you know, you're kind of working in your little pastry like whole, and you have your own little place in the kitchen typically, and most of it's behind the scenes. I usually leave before the customers even get there, so it's pretty isolated.
Selene, tell me, how did you get into printmaking?
I was in Chicago actually, and I was making things. I was making cards. I was carving into rubber stamps to make cards and prints and things to sell there. And I said, there's got to be a faster way to do this. So somebody said, there is. It's called letterpress printing. Instead of 10 an hour, you can do 100 an hour. And so I started taking classes at Columbia College in Chicago and then just committed as much time as they would actually take me, and met Jim Sheradin, who was running Hatch at the time, and kept running into him at these events. And then he mentioned that the shop was going to move and it was going to be in a bigger space. He didn't say it was going to have 80 feet of glass. So here I am, because Hatch was moving, but not to Chicago. So I had to come to Nashville.
So now that you're behind glass, you were very much not behind the scenes anymore.
Well, most people, when they come to see us, they're focused on what's coming off those presses, because that's where the color gets laid down. That's where the type is locked up, where the images are locked up and they're inked. And that's when the posters are coming off the press, either halfway done or fully done. So really, at the end of the day, they may know our hands really well, but they don't, and the posters they know really well, but they may not remember our faces.
Alex, you have a less artistic background, it seems.
That's right.
What I'm most fascinated by is how you kind of got started as a hacker.
So let's go back 15 years ago to Dial Up and the Song of My People. And I played a lot of video games, and I had a friend that could modify items in a video game that I played a lot. And I was really interested in, you know, how can he get the best gear in the game? And he's only like level 10. And from there, you know, I got hooked on it. I didn't know how to program, so he kind of had to help me along. Once I got the basics down, he introduced me to some friends. Well, they're friends now, but they were complete strangers then. That really opened up a whole new world to me of programming, malicious code. For me, to get into that, it wasn't so much of, I didn't want to go take down computer networks or anything like that. It was, I could beat an antivirus company at what they said they could do 100%. It stuck. For me, it became a lifestyle. And now we fast forward almost 16 years, and I'm protecting, you know, Fortune 500 companies from people like myself when I was growing up. So
I would just like to make the observation that I think for the three of us here, I know I don't know you guys that well, but I'm going to say obsessive compulsive tendencies probably come into play.
In fact, you might want to retitle this.
For us at Hatch, a lot of us, all of us, in addition to designing and printing posters 40 plus hours a week, every single person on the staff makes their own artwork, which is pretty incredible. And we're all there sometimes 9 or 10 o'clock at night, 3 or 4 nights a week. Like, I think one of the things that ties us all together is just this intensity of towards our processes, the different processes that we do, and the satisfaction that we get when you can see the completed result.
And you could see this as the three of them were talking. Like, their eyes would light up as they talked about their respective crafts. Lisa said even after grueling days at Husk, she would still cook dinner for her family and just experiment in her kitchen.
So, yeah, I would go home and usually stay up until 3 or 4 in the morning and not sleep a lot.
Alex, do you work on programming and stuff like that after work?
I do. So my day, you know, I work for 12 hours and then I go home and work for another 10 hours. And that's my normal week. But, you know, for me, it's the idea of being able to take something that started in here and I can put it in code and then, you know, shortly later make it real.
As a hacker, it seems like it is this kind of weird dichotomy where you are behind the scenes, like literally in your parents' basement, but also having your stuff out there.
Right. So online, you go by a handle. Nobody knows your real name.
What was your handle?
Not going to say. Sorry. No Google searches for you guys. It was behind the scenes. I mean, nobody knew other than the people I affiliated with who I was. But they didn't know my real name. They didn't know where I lived. They didn't know anything. They just knew I was some kid wanting to learn. As time went on, we go forward a little bit, people really started to recognize who I was by that name online, but there was never a picture with the name.
But eventually, someone did recognize Alex as Alex, and that really changed the trajectory of his life.
I was in high school, and I had a federal agent come to my school. And now you're thinking, get arrested, get thrown down on the ground, get taken to Gitmo or something like that. It was nothing like that. This guy came to my school who is now a really good friend of mine, and he's like, you need molding. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you could make so much money doing what you're doing now. And from there, you know, I got the right training.
The federal agent introduced him to DEF CON, a huge hacking conference where Alex gained some fame by speaking there as a teenager. Now, of course, about a decade and a half later, he has a successful, legitimate career. Do you feel like you gave anything up by going on the straight and narrow?
I don't, actually. So it's better now. So I have a lab. I can set it up however I want, whenever I want, and I can do whatever I want to it. And then the team that I work with, I can utilize them for my testing. So I kind of get the lab from like James Bond that Q has, you know, to do whatever I want. And I love it, you know, because I can't afford that type of stuff.
Is there anything that you miss about it?
There is, you know, some of the friends that I had growing up that, you know, I've known almost my whole entire life, you know, with various job changes and things that I do, you know, I've had to cut myself off from talking to them because, you know, depending on what they're doing and if I'm doing an investigation and they're part of that investigation, I can't be like, hey, man, you need to knock this off or anything like that. I have to treat them as a normal attacker. So there's various people that, you know, I just don't talk to anymore, I don't affiliate with, so I can get my job done at the end of the day.
Lisa has also gained some fame from her career. She's been published in Food and Wine magazine, Saveur, Southern Living. Part of it, she says, comes from this new fascination with celebrity chefs.
You see less and less of this sort of, you know, I'm just dedicated to this work. I think people can see now like, oh, I can, you know, I can get a million-dollar book deal and I can do this if I just really promote myself. And it's a... You know, it's a hard conversation, I think, for chefs to have. We don't ever have it with ourselves, with each other. That authenticity, I think some of us fear for it. You know, like as soon as my head starts spinning too much with all these opportunities, which are phenomenal, and producers emailing you for this show and this show, which I've just said no to all of, you check in with your original intention, I think. I've been able to see how far and fast I can take this. And it, trust me, it's alluring. I mean, it's fame, it's money, it's, you know, it's, for me, it just, it's not what I want. I want the long road. And I want to wake up every day and kind of remember my original intention, which was to do work that I'm proud of. And that doesn't mean being, you know, competing on a show, that just isn't for me. You know, I do question, to be perfectly honest, is this a road I want to continue going down? I don't, you know, is that the version of success for this field these days?
One thing I wanted to say was, I think because of the internet, a lot of people are able to spend more time searching or finding the sources of things, the sources of food and the sources of design and the sources of how things are made. And I think that's probably what's led to a much keener interest in who chefs are and who the pastry chefs are versus the sous chefs versus the head chefs and things like that, and interest in the roots of the food that she's making versus the posters that I'm making and things like that.
When do you find your job most fulfilling? Like, obviously you all enjoy creating things, but is there kind of a moment where something happened that made you feel like this was the most fulfilling thing?
Oh yeah. It's quite.
My follow up is what was that moment?
So I would have to say, last year at the Technology Awards, I was a finalist for Software Developer of the Year, out of you know, a couple thousand entries for that, and to be in that same category as an individual with, you know, huge companies that are designing software, I think that was definitely a turning point for me, that I was like, I'm doing the right thing, you know?
The first poster I designed at Hatch was for Crosby, Stills, and Nash at the Ryman, which in itself is pretty awesome. I got to put a guitar on it, which is pretty cool. I happened to be working in the retail store the day after the show, and an adult fellow and his father came to the shop. All the posters had sold out at the Ryman, and they were only able to get one, and they wanted to see if there was another one. This was the first time they had been able to get together in person in 3 years. They decided to rendezvous in Nashville, take in the Crosby, Stills, and Nash show, and just hang out. And of all the things that they could purchase so that each could have one, it was the Hatch poster. So, you know, for me, that's pretty awesome in terms of just being able to be part of somebody's, you know, family life in that way.
I think the reason I bake in this one instance that happened was, it was when I was the pastry chef at City House. One of the servers came and She said, there's a guy on the patio. He wants to talk to you about your rhubarb pie. And I was like, oh. And initially I was like, oh God, something's wrong. Like he found something terrible in it. Or like I went straight to panic mode and I walk out and about to be like really apologetic. And I've got my story ready for like what I'm going to do. And in my memory is like a child's memory where like he was just ancient. Like he must have been 750 years old. And he was sitting there in the corner table with his back against the wall. And so when I walked in, he was directly facing me and he was hunched over this pie. And so I go over and I said, you know, is everything okay? And he's crying. he's sobbing. And he looked up and he was holding his spoon. And I remember very clearly, like my kids used to hold their ice cream spoons. And he said, I haven't had a rhubarb pie like this since my grandmother used to make it for me. And she died when I was like 7 or 8. And this is just as good as my grandmama used to make for me. And he's just having this visceral memory of his grandmother, and I start crying and I sit down and we're both like over this pie talking about rhubarb and what I did and like, can you just like tell me like what you put in it? And I said, I'll tell you everything. And by the end of it, we were like holding hands, disgusting mess over this rhubarb pie. And I don't care if I win any awards or how far this career takes me. That was probably like the most important thing that's happened to me thus far.
We opened up the mic to our audience in Studio C to ask Lisa, Selene, and Alex some questions. Remember Selene's comment, they were all a little obsessive compulsive? The questions focused on that.
So your jobs sound very addicting, and I'm curious as to how you have personal lives. Because it sounds like you don't sleep and you work 22 hours a day if you're Alex. So how do you have these fantastic jobs that you obviously love so much, but live as a human?
I start to winnow out anything that's unnecessary. Mm-hmm. So like I don't own a television and things like that. So I don't, since my time is precious because I want to be doing lots of things, but I also, I do love food. So I want to do things like make sure I get to the farmer's market and go to great restaurants and things like that. And do spend that quality time with the friends, but I try to winnow out the needlessness and the distractions that everything, you know, in the marketing world wants you to pay attention to really. And I was a former marketer, so I'm really good at detecting that.
So my day is pretty crazy. I get out of bed and I go straight to work. And I can't sit still for very long. I always have to be active, right? But seriously, like my week this week, I just got back from traveling last week. I was in Texas. I came home. I went right to work over the weekend. I got up Monday and I went straight to a conference. I've been in a think tank session for the last 72 hours, but I just go till I crash.
What resonates with me is the obsessive compulsive side of things and how that can lead to perfectionism and kind of isolation. And I'm wondering how that might translate for you guys to either work in a team or how you can kind of open yourself up to share your knowledge and education for like the next generation of makers out there.
That's really hard for me, and I didn't know it until I had 3 or 4 cooks under me for the very first time all of a sudden. And you know, when those desserts go out, they go out with my name on them, even if I'm out of town for a week and 4 other people are producing them. It's a really, really stressful thing. It was hard enough for me that I had to really sort of reconsider if that was how I wanted to be a pastry chef. So yeah, it's a difficult thing for me.
With letterpress printing, because it's an outmoded technology, we're actually critically dependent on the community. That forces you to be collaborative for problem solving in situations that we get into where we don't know what happened, because there are huge gaps. We have objects or items in the shop that we don't necessarily know what they were used for. the beautiful thing about letterpress printing is that there's going to be another problem that comes up in 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 weeks. So you'll have that opportunity to solve it yourself then.
I work in a team full of OCD people. So it's very interesting because, especially with forensics, because you can't be wrong. You have to be right 100% of the time. So I really enjoy, you know, working with team, even though everybody has different opinions on how something should be done, the outcome for us is always the same. When I work here in Nashville, I'm the only one on my team. So I do get that alone time where I get to work by myself.
If you all had another career that you would like to have done, what would it be? So Lisa, if you didn't do this, what would you want to do? Celine, if you didn't do this, what would you want to do?
Definitely, yeah, movie director. I like telling stories, and it's whether it's 40 words on a poster or getting somebody to cry in a movie theater. I think that rhubarb pie would be great for a movie.
I think the easy answer for me is to just continue to try to find my way back around to writing full time, and I would love to write screenplays, and then she can direct it. And there, this was the whole reason for this meeting. But like the real like cheesy girl heart of heart answers is my dream my whole life was to be a dancer. And
I was a dancer too.
See, I don't know what other than I'm falling in love moment by moment.
I was not a dancer. And I would have to say probably firefighter. I went to an academy twice for firefighting and become a company command officer. So that type of work is very, very rewarding. If I could do it over again, that's what I would do.
But all three of them clarified they feel incredibly lucky to be doing what they're doing, which is basically making a living and a name for themselves simply by making what they love. Here's Alex.
I had somebody when I was in high school that told me that, you know, you're never going to get into college. You're never going to do anything with your life. You're never going to leave this town. Well, they're partially right. I never went to college. But, you know, I work for one of the big four now. I can't be any happier than where I'm at. You know, I get the schooling I need. It's tons of fun.
I started taking letterpress printing classes in September of 2007. That's not even 8 years ago. And now I get to work in basically the oldest shop in America, letterpress poster shop in America. And that's pretty awesome.
I mean, that's right around when my ball got rolling was about 2007. I mean, that is a quick trajectory. And, you know, I'm leaving Saturday to go to San Francisco because I've been invited to teach baking classes and I've been invited to cook for Diana Kennedy, who, like, is really the Julia Child of, like, Mexican cuisine. And I'm, you know, had you asked me 7 years ago what I wanted to get out of it, I never could have imagined that that was even on the table. So, you know, I feel grateful.
Well, thank you so much for being here. This is really fascinating to hear your stories. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can connect with our guests online. They're all on different social media platforms. Lisa Donovan is on Twitter, at Buttermilk Road. Alexander Berta is on LinkedIn, which is linkedin.com/in/AlexanderBerta. And Selene Aubrey is on Instagram, at CAUBRY4. I'm Emily Seiner. You can follow me at Seiner Says on Twitter, or please send us an email with your thoughts on the show at movers@WPLN.org. Special thanks to Tom Knox for recording the show, Carl Peterson for setting up the studio, Mac Linebaugh for being the show's digital guru, and Holly Linebaugh for taking pictures. You can find those pictures on Nashville Public Radio's Facebook page. And you can join us for our next Movers and Thinkers event. We'll be posting that information on social media and on our website, WPLN.org.